Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, and more West, and then another West. Transmitting across the internet. This is episode 312 of Registry Matters. Larry! Been a long time since we've spoken. How are you this evening?
Doing awesome.
That's it? Nothing?
Glad to be back with you.
Do you have any important messages of things that you should not do? Like, what was it, carrying pounds and pounds and pounds of some illegal substance? No more stories
yes.
like that?
I forgot to put that in for tonight. I do. Do you want me to give you Larry's general rule for episode 312 now?
No, let's get through the intro. We'll say hi to Chance, and then we'll come back around to this.
Okay.
Chance, what's up over there on the West Coast?
Sun. I mean, same old stuff, just better.
Endless sun. Same old stuff, just better, huh? That's awesome.
Same old stuff, just better. I mean, that's California, man.
Are you recording that from like California. A sailboat in the what would be the bay out there? Like, are you near like the little island of Catalina? Is that the Catalina Island? Is that what that is?
I see it right out my window. That's right.
Fantastic.
Just floating out there in the sunset.
God, can't
Beautiful.
Even imagine. Can't even imagine. All right, Larry, now tell us what you've got going on. What is your general rule for episode 312?
Well, I would urge people to pay careful attention to this one. If you are carrying 400 fentanyl pills with you, I would suggest that you pay for your merchandise. Do not go to a restaurant or anything and walk a bill. Because if you do, the police might not be very kind to you when they find 400 fentanyl pills in your possession. So pay your restaurant bill, pay for your smokes or anything like that. Try to keep a minimal amount of police attention in your direction when you're carrying that much fentanyl. But I would really urge you not to be carrying fentanyl. But if you must do it, make sure you pay your bills.
I see. Where do you think the fentanyl came from?
Well, I have no idea. But the rumor is it comes from Mexico and from China and all these places. And we're a big magnet here in Albuquerque for it. So I'm told.
Is it just because you're a coastal state that, or a border state, excuse me, not coastal, but a border state, and then move it to the other 73 states?
That's the theory, that the interstates 25 and 40 make for rapid progression around the country. But I don't know. We'll have to get a fentanyl expert up. Maybe I can reach out to the detention center and see if he would like to be a guest.
Chance, do you know where the joke about the 73 states or whichever states that's not 50 comes from?
No, I haven't heard that one.
All right. So like, I don't know, 2 months maybe after I had gotten locked up, I got transferred over to this other facility for holding until I actually got moved into the Georgia state prison system. And I'm laying there in my bunk and I'm really green. And somebody goes, well, you know, there are those 52 states. And I was like, I can't let that go. And I got into an argument with a bunch of people about how many states there are. And they said, prove it. And I'm like, we don't have a library. How do you prove that there are or are not 50 or 52 states if you don't have access to any resources? Because there was no library for me to go to and find the encyclopedia. What do you do?
Start with your fingers, I guess. What do you do?
But if you try to name them, you could purposely exclude a name or two and you only arrive at 50 and you purposely left off the other two states.
Yeah, that's true. That's
so true. These individuals were saying that Alaska and Hawaii were 51 and 52. And I was like, no, I'm pretty sure that they are 49 and 50. But again, and you know, don't have arguments with people in prison who are going to punch your face in, even if you're right. That's the moral of that story.
Okay. All right. Agreed.
All right.
Agreed. Yes.
Okay. Now with that said, Larry, what are we doing tonight?
We have a case from the Michigan Supreme Court that it's a win, goes into the win column for us. We have a segment where I respond to some listener feedback that you made me aware of. And Chance, and Chance is here with a very special guest. And Chance, would you do us a favor and kindly tell us a little bit about that particular segment?
Well, I am honored and privileged to do so. It's gonna, you know, it's gonna pertain to You Don't Have to Live Under the Shadow of the Registry with our special guest, James, who's an advocate for social justice and criminal justice reform.
That means people need to stay with us so they can hear from James. And we have a few articles if time permits, but unfortunately time will not permit this week because I didn't do any work on the articles. So even if time does permit, we're not going to get to them.
I need whoever that was just now to turn on streamer mode. Was that you, James?
No, that wasn't me.
Okay. I heard a Discord beep message, so I wanted to make sure. I think it was you. But all right, anyway, we'll go on. Larry, you need to set this up. Do you want me to just start reading, or do you want to set it up?
Well, you informed me that we had received some feedback from one of our longtime patrons, and I said something last week about radio host Dan Bongino being a pathological liar, and he challenged me about that issue. So I would like to go into the fairness issue, because also I've been ridiculed from time to time that I'm not fair to conservatives, and I don't say good things about conservatives, and I don't bash the Democrats. And I think, well, gee, I don't know what podcast you listen to, because I bash the Democratic Party all the time. I mean, it's hardly an episode that goes by that I don't say something a little bit critical of the Democratic Party, because they're not the solution to all of our problems either. But I wanted to set up a little clip that we're going to do from this particular listener said, why don't you ever say anything good about President Bush? And I said, well, he's been out of office for a number of years, but if you tell me what you want me to play from President Bush, I'll do it. Because if he's been for criminal justice reform and it slipped through my radar detection, show it to me and I'll play it. So I was sent an article that said that Bush pushed the Second Chance Act. And I went and did some digging, although I shouldn't have had to do it. And I have this little clip, and we're going to play it just like I said I would, that President Bush did propose something favorable for incarcerated people leaving prison.
Tonight, I ask you to consider.
Oh my God, I knew it was going to do that. I tried to do something fancy, Larry, and it burned me. I tried.
Tonight, I ask you to consider another group of Americans in need of help. This year, some 600,000 inmates will be released from prison back into society. We know from long experience that if they can't find work or a home or help, they are much more likely to commit crime and return to prison. So tonight I propose a four-year, $300 million prisoner reentry initiative to expand job training and placement services, to provide transitional housing, and to help newly released prisoners get mentoring, including from faith-based groups.
Now, I would like to describe what people are hearing.
Hold
there.
Hold on one second. It's almost over. There's one. You wanted it to go
America
a little further.
America is a land of second chance. And when the gates of the prison open, the path ahead should lead to a better life.
All right, go ahead.
I would like to describe for those who are not able to see what they're hearing. They are hearing massive bipartisan applause. The chamber people are sitting the way the State of the Union and the way the chambers are organized. The partisan divide is each side of the aisle when they literally are on one side of the chamber versus the other. For those who can't see it, people, members of the Democrat Party, rose and cheered President Bush. Did you see that, Andy, when you did the clip?
I did.
Okay, now can you imagine President Biden proposing something and having massive applause and people rising on both sides of the aisle, like what happened in that State of the Union address?
To be fair, Larry, I bet you very few Democrats stood for Trump during those 4 years.
I would say that's probably true. I didn't watch the State of the Union addresses I haven't watched a number of them for a number of years, I should say.
There was the one where Nancy Pelosi tore up the whole script.
And I criticized Nancy Pelosi for that.
I remember that.
I said it was very beneath the dignity of the speakership of the House, and it was disgusting to me. And I did it. I would like for once for someone to criticize something that President Trump does or has done. And that's what we're going to go into tonight in terms of the hypocrisy. And we're going to keep going, and you can set up the rest of it.
Very good. All right. Well, we received a listener comment from one of our longtime patrons, and who challenged you, that would be you, Larry, to provide some examples of when Dan Bongino lies. Can you do that?
Well, I'm familiar with the supporter, and we certainly appreciate his longtime generous support. However, I do stand behind my comments that Bongino lies continuously. But maybe it would be helpful if we started the discussion by defining what constitutes lying.
Is lying anything where you don't tell the truth?
Well, agreed. That is, but a person can state something incorrectly and believe it's correct when they make the statement and later find out that their preliminary statements were incomplete or inaccurate. Did that person deliberately lie about that statement? I think not. On the other hand, a person can deliberately make false statements that they know to be false at the time when they make the statements, and they do it anyway. And example, before I keep going, did President George W. Bush, the one that we just gave accolades, did he lie when he said that we were going into Iraq to get weapons of mass destruction that were not found? Or was he relying on information that he believed to be true at the time he made the statement?
The way that I understand that, Larry, is I think that he believed the information he had at the time. I believe that to be true. I think that's what has come out.
Okay, and that's what I'm setting up here. Something turning out to be false does not mean it was a lie. But another form of lying, which Mr. Bongino is good at, is when he takes something that is partially true completely out of context. For example, does anyone remember the attempted assassination of President Reagan?
I sort of do. I was very young.
Well, Chance, should remember it. Do you remember it? Well, there was a
Exactly where I was. Oh, yeah, I do.
There was a very strong outcry about the statement made by Secretary of State Alexander Haig, where he said, quote, "I'm in control here." Haig's critics took that statement completely out of context to find fault with him. Mr. Bongino does that continuously. Now, let me just tell you what Mr. Haig said, because I've got it pretty well in my memory. He said, "I'm in control here in the White House, pending the return of the vice president, whom I'm in very close contact with. And if anything should happen, of course, I would consult with him." And then when you put the backdrop of the context that the Soviet Union was expected to roll tanks into Poland to put down the Solidarity labor movement under Lech Walesa, if you put that into context, and that we had the president down, the spokesman for the White House, Press Secretary Brady down, and we had a deputy press secretary answering reporters' questions, and he said, was asked pointedly, "Who's in control?" And he said, "I don't know. I'll have to get back to you." Well, General Haig didn't think that was a good message to send to the rest of the world, that nobody knew who was in control. Well, Bongino does that all the time when he makes statements about inflation being the worst ever. That's totally out of context. First, inflation has cooled dramatically since it peaked in 2022. Second, we had far higher inflation back in the Nixon and Ford administrations of the 1970s. So terrible that conservative Republican President Nixon imposed wage and price controls. We did have some uncomfortably high inflation post-pandemic, but Biden was not responsible. He was not the responsible party any more than Nixon was responsible for the runaway inflation of the 1970s. That's what Bongino does all the time. He takes things that are partially true completely out of context.
Hey, Larry, weren't the mortgage interest rates in that time frame, weren't they in the double digits?
They were indeed. They were far higher than the rates we have today. But our supporter doesn't remember that. I think it's age. He's not old enough, or lack of desire to actually fully develop the arguments he's making. But we had far higher inflation, far higher interest rates back then. And Bongino says this is the worst inflation ever. Well, ever might be in your lifetime. That would constitute ever. But it's by no means ever, because we've had
not far your lifetime for sure.
Well, not for my lifetime, for sure.
Since you were there at the signing of the Declaration of Independence.
So, well, I was there for that, yes.
Well, how frequently do you torture yourself and listen to these radio programs, particularly Bongino?
Almost every day. I'll listen to him when I'm exercising in the mornings and when I'm on the road driving. I know it's kind of bizarre, but I need to know the latest nonsense he's spewing to his audience.
And on that then, so what nonsense has he been spewing lately?
Well, the latest is that the Secret Service is covering up evidence and that they're totally incompetent to handle the responsibilities, which included providing protection for a number of people as well as foreign dignitaries. Mr. Bongino has consistently proclaimed that he's not a rush-to-judgment person, especially when police officers have been accused of criminal conduct. Now, he says, we need to take it slow, take it easy. I'm not a rush-to-judgment type of guy. And he's made these proclamations repeatedly, stating that the facts need to come out before we jump to fire or prosecute police officers. Magically, Mr. Bongino does not adhere to that view now when it comes to the Secret Service. He's demanding that people be fired before the investigation is barely commenced, much less completed. Where's the due process for these agents? Now, Mr. Bongino claims he's a due process type of guy. Where is the due process? If they're fired immediately, I can almost guarantee you that they will not cooperate with any thorough investigation. Why would they? If Mr. Bongino really wants to get to the bottom of what happened, do not rush to judgment. Let the investigation proceed. Let's find out what happened. Let's see how far up the food chain it goes. And let's do what needs to be done after we know who's responsible. But all these people are going to clam up, and some of them will lawyer up. If they get fired, chance that you're a lawyer. Can you conceive of a scenario that if a Secret Service agent got hung out to dry right now, particularly with the federal civil service protections, can you see a scenario where they might just lawyer themselves up and consider action against the government and that they might refuse to cooperate with any further investigation? Is that an imaginal scenario to you, or am I going crazy here?
No, not in this environment. That's completely foreseeable in this environment, for sure.
So, well... Okay, well, that's what I'm saying in response to Mr. Bongino, to the fact that he lies all the time. He creates panic, he creates mistrust, and he does it continuously for ratings. We don't do any of that here. We try to tell the truth as we understand it to be, and we try to be neutral and fair about the truth. He cares nothing about fairness and neutrality. He cares about money and audience ratings.
What else do you want to cover in regards to hypocrisy? I can't resist, because this one I do find funny.
For you to come back and call bigots my admirers is a farce. It's an act of hypocrisy. It's a terrible way to treat a guest on your show, and you know it.
All right, now you can go ahead.
Okay, well, I have another article I want to talk about, and it tangentially connects with this. I get criticism and I get questions all the time. Larry, why don't you understand that Biden just totally, I've heard this barrage of criticism about the student loan forgiveness program. The critics say he bypassed Congress and is acting like a dictator. You've heard that, right?
I have heard these things, yes.
Well, the funny thing is, these same critics have been amazingly silent when it comes to Trump bypassing Congress. For example, I have an article from August 10th, 2020. Do you happen to recall that a presidential election campaign was underway at that time?
I'm pretty sure I do, yes.
Well, you know, President Trump bypassed Congress on this and other issues. The article states, quote, President Trump Saturday authorized the Federal Emergency Management Agency to use $44 billion of Stafford Aid disaster relief funds to supplement individuals' wages resulting from lost work due to COVID-19 public health emergency. The president's directive said that states and territories that apply for funds may distribute through their unemployment insurance system $400 per week, including a $300 federal contribution to individuals who currently receive at least $100 a week in unemployment compensation benefits and can self-certify that they're unemployed or unavailable to work due to disruptions caused by COVID-19. Now, these are funds that were authorized by Congress for emergency relief for disasters, for hurricanes, anything that's a disaster. And the president at that time, Mr. Trump, authorized the expenditure of tens of billions of dollars. And the article goes on to say the White House and FEMA continue to work on guidance for state distributions, and the program will be applied retroactively for the week ending August 1st. It can continue no later than December 6th. Wow, just about a month after the election. Or until the balance of the disaster relief fund reaches $25 billion, or until Congress enacts a separate replacement unemployment relief program. So this was the president deciding that he was going to provide his own relief. Now, I'm all for this. I'm for this. I was for it at the time. But amazingly, I'm calling out the hypocrisy of the people who don't seem to notice anything that their guy does. And they seem to be very critical of everything that somebody wearing a different political affiliation does. This was not authorized by Congress, yet he did it anyway. I do not recall any Republican complaining about Mr. Trump bypassing Congress. Where are you guys? Where are you? If bypassing Congress and spending money that's not authorized, he not only did this, he also took money from a segment of the military budget to build the border wall that was authorized. I think it was out of the procurement budget. And I'll just go into some people that don't understand the military budget. There's a huge grand total, but the military budget is divided into multiple components. You have personnel, that's one component. You have operation and maintenance, which is another component, which pays for our deployments and our foreign bases. And you have research and development. And then you have procurement, which is the acquisition of weapons. I think it came from the procurement budget. But he did not have the authority to do that. Where are you guys when you're criticizing a president that hijacks and does things without congressional approval? If you're going to be intellectually honest, let's be completely intellectually honest. That's what we do here at FYP Education.
Are we done with this segment? Anything else?
Well, I hope so, but I have a feeling that we won't be, because someone will come back and say that I've missed something here. And if I have, we'll go back to it and we'll cover it again. But I would very much like to hear equality and criticism. If Biden is a dictator, then Trump was a dictator.
Obama before that.
I support the extra relief for the unemployed people, but it was not appropriated by Congress. And I support, well, I don't say I support the border wall, but I support some flexibility in presidents being able to move money around, because they're the executive and they have to be able to administer things. And sometimes Congress can't act quickly enough to approve of flexibility. But don't call somebody a dictator unless you're going to call your guy a dictator also.
Especially the guy who says he's going to be a dictator on day one.
Yeah, that guy.
Right?
I don't know who you're talking about.
I didn't make that one up. I'm not pulling that one out of my tushy. He said that, right? So,
he did say that.
All right. Well, let's move along. We have a case from Michigan, and that's their Supreme Court even. And it's the People versus Lyman. Would you go with that pronunciation, Larry? Lyman?
I would indeed.
Cool. The court examined the application of Michigan's SORA to non-sexual offenses. Really? The question is whether the application of SORA constitutes cruel or unusual punishment under the Michigan Constitution. Now tell me, Larry, what is the origin of this case?
Well, this decision arose from the case of Cora Lyman, who was convicted of several crimes, including torture and unlawful imprisonment, but not any sexual offenses.
And the court ultimately ruled that applying SORA to non-sexual offenders violates the constitutional prohibition against cruel or unusual punishment. Now, you've pontificated for years that registration is not cruel or unusual punishment. Can you finally admit that it is, please?
No, I cannot.
And why is that?
Because the court held its cruel and unusual punishment under the Michigan Constitution, not the U.S. Constitution, and it's cruel or unusual, not cruel and unusual as in the U.S. Constitution.
Now, come on, Larry. Now you're playing like semantics on some words here. What's the difference between the two?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because the court addressed that difference in footnote 7. They stated the parallel provision in the federal Constitution provides that the government shall not inflict cruel and unusual punishments. And that's the United States Constitution Amendment. Is it 8? I guess that's 8.
It looks like an 8 to me, yes. V-I-I-I-I-I-I is an 8.
This court previously recognized that the Michigan Constitution use of or rather than and provides additional protection beyond its federal counterpart, as it prohibits punishments that are cruel even if they're not unusual, and it prohibits punishments that are unusual even if they're not cruel. So in the U.S. Constitution, it has to be cruel and unusual, and under the Michigan Constitution, it has to be cruel or unusual. So I'm not playing word games. That's what was the crux of them being able to get to that decision. It's cruel or unusual in the instance of the Michigan Constitution.
And for my simpleton brain here, this would be something similar to where Maryland provides a higher level of protection. This is Michigan providing a higher level where it's not an and, it's an or, where it can be either or, therefore unconstitutional?
That is correct. Similar to Maryland, their constitution prohibits any disadvantages as a result of an ex post facto law.
I see. All right. Well, can we go into the background a bit?
Let's do it.
All right, Cora Lyman was convicted by a jury in Wayne Circuit Court on multiple charges. Three counts of torture, three counts of unlawful imprisonment, one count of felonious assault, and one count of possession of a firearm during the commission of a felony. The incidents leading to these convictions involved Lyman holding his wife and two minor children at gunpoint, threatening to kill them and burn down their house. The court sentenced him to various prison terms for these convictions, totaling between 126 and 240 months. I did not hear of anything related to PFR-type offenses here. Did I miss something?
You did not hear anything. And the court noted, despite the absence of any sexual component in his crimes, Lyman was required to register as a Tier 1 PFR under SORA because his unlawful imprisonment charges involved minors. The court held that this registration imposed, despite his argument that a lack of sexual component made the registry requirement inappropriate and punitive in nature.
Let's walk around how this case even then progressed. Lyman appealed his conviction and placement on the PFR registry in Michigan. The Michigan Court of Appeals affirmed his convictions, but ordered the removal of his name from the PFR registry, concluding that imposing SORA on a crime without a sexual component constituted cruel or unusual punishment. The prosecution cross-appealed, challenging the removal from the registry. The Michigan Supreme Court was tasked with determining whether SORA's application to non-sexual crimes violates constitutional protections against cruel or unusual punishment. There's been extensive litigation in Michigan challenging the registry. Can you walk us through it, if you don't mind, please?
Very briefly, when SORA was first enacted in 1994 in Michigan, it was a confidential database intended to assist law enforcement. But as you know, it didn't stay that way. Over the years, amendments transformed it into a publicly accessible registry that significantly restricted registrants' lives. In 2021, SORA was amended again to address constitutional concerns about its punitive effects, and this was largely due to the Doe versus Snyder case that was decided by the Sixth Circuit. However, the central issue remained concerns about its punitive effect. I'm losing my train of thought here. The central issue remained whether these amendments sufficiently altered SORA's nature for non-sexual offenders, meaning those who didn't have an underlying sexual conviction.
Now, that since they held that SORA is cruel or unusual punishment, does this apply to other PFRs who have been convicted of PFR-type offenses?
No, it does not, at least not for the time being. In footnote 6, the court stated, Lyman litigated the issue of cruel or unusual punishment as applied to himself. This case did not involve others. The court stated, accordingly, our analysis and decision concerns only whether the application of 2021 SORA to non-sexual offenders like Lyman constitutes cruel or unusual punishment. We leave for another day and another case whether the 2021 SORA constitutes punishment, and more specifically, cruel or unusual punishment when applied to other offenders. Now, that is almost an invitation, as far as I can see. Further, they stated, to the extent the Court of Appeals decision in this case determined that 2021 SORA constitutes punishment, as to all offenders, we vacate that conclusion. What they did telegraph to me as an unauthorized practitioner of law, what they telegraphed to me was that we're onto this, but we're going to make sure it's set up correctly because this was not proper. This was not a part of this case in controversy. And for you to go this far this early without this being a part of the controversy is premature. But to me, that's an invitation. And I suspect that the ACLU of Michigan and other people are going to be right on this, and they're going to challenge whether the 2021 SORA constitutes cruel or unusual punishment. That would be my guess. And Chance, if I've missed it, you jump in here and tell me where I'm off the rails.
No, I don't think you are. I mean, you know, this is a case where you just have to have good common sense. I mean, you know, the prosecutors are saying, hey, how come we can't? No, they can't use it, okay, because if they do, yes, it is punishment. They're very, very, very clear. Why can't we? You can't because there's no sexual gratification or compulsion here. It's just being used for that purpose. But it also sets up the platform through the analysis of the factors that this could go forward in a big way, you know, based on, you know, their own constitution. So I like the way that it's forming out.
Hey, Larry, this seems like a good time that we could bring up the Kennedy-Mendoza-Martina factors. Do you think that this would be a good time to use these?
Yes, the court applied the Kennedy versus Mendoza-Martinez factors to assess whether SORA constituted punishment.
And would you run us through what those factors are?
I'll do my best. I cut and pasted them from the decision. Whether the sanction, meaning the registration requirement, involves an affirmative disability restraint. And I always love that being first because I think that is the most important thing. Whether it has historically been regarded as punishment. Whether it comes into play only on a finding of scienter. Whether its operation will promote the traditional aims of punishment, retribution, and deterrence. Whether the behavior to which it applies to is already a crime. And whether an affirmative purpose to which it may be rationally connected to is assignable for it, and whether it appears excessive in relation to the alternative purpose assigned. Now, that doesn't sound like exactly that came from the U.S. Supreme Court decision, but that's what was in there. In the case, the case is Kennedy versus Mendoza-Martinez, and it was from sometime in the 1960s, 372 U.S. at 144. It's an old, old case, but these factors cause a lot of consternation, especially where you've got your cursor right now. People never understand that one, and I argue with lawyers about what that means. And
I was going to ask one of you, either you, Larry, or Chance, to please redefine scienter. It looks like science spelled poorly.
Just think of it as intent.
Okay, so whether it comes into play only on a finding of intent, to read it differently?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good way of thinking about it.
I would expand a little bit to say scienter would include knowledge as well, and the argument comes in with the legal professionals is whether or not the original crime requires a finding of scienter, I disagree with them vehemently on that. I believe that is not what the Supreme Court meant in Kennedy versus Mendoza-Martinez. I believe that they mean whether the regulatory scheme, if you can be punished and be held accountable for the regulatory scheme without knowledge that you're subject to it. That's what I believe it means. So too many people brief this on appeal when they try to even address that factor. Most of the time they're too confused to know how to address it, but they address it incorrectly because I believe that, like, for example, a speed limit sign. If the speed limit sign is not there, or if you didn't see it because of a little bit of overgrowth, we really don't care. We don't care whether you had knowledge or not. You're speeding, and we're going to give you a ticket. The cop's going to give you a ticket. Now, some nice cop might not give you a ticket if you can show him that the sign is gone, but you know he's going to say, you know, this is a school zone. You know this is a residential area. You shouldn't be going 65 miles an hour through here. So whether or not you know it. So that, to me, is what that's talking about. If you're going to be penalized for failure to comply with registration, you must know that you have a duty to register. We can all agree on that, I think. Not a soul has ever been prosecuted that didn't know they're supposed to register. So therefore, I believe that this factor would cut in our favor because that shows that there is a requirement that scienter be there. But the lawyer's saying, well, no, Larry, some of the crimes don't require scienter, like statutory rape. So therefore, it's not, no, you're misinterpreting that. But this is for another day. But that particular factor is very confusing, even for courts themselves. I've seen courts, when they write their decision, say, well, we already don't know how to evaluate this factor because it wasn't really thoroughly briefed. And they don't know how to assign any weighting to that factor.
Can I ask a question then about there was the guy in Alabama that had come from Colorado, and he goes down to the office to see if he had to register. Had he never been there, this would be scienter? He didn't know he had a duty to register. Therefore, what you just said is no one's ever been prosecuted for not knowing.
Yes, that would be kind of a good example. That man predated Colorado registration. Had he gone about his life in Alabama and never registered, say he got detected, he had been detected by some mechanism, detected him, he would have not been prosecuted. He would have been given a notice of duty to register because they could never prove scienter. They would never be able to present a single document that he knew he had an obligation to register.
I mean, you know, Andy, from a legal perspective, if you're looking at it, you'll get a definition kind of like this. Scienter is a legal term that refers to a person's knowledge of wrongdoing or intent to act despite that knowledge. It's a mental state that indicates a person acted illegally or with reckless disregard for the truth. It's often an element of liability, especially in cases of fraud. So, you know, it could be both or a mixture or one to the other. In terms of intent, it could be general intent. It could be specific intent. It could be implied intent. So, you know, it's not exactly the easiest thing to define.
Sure. Well, suppose somebody in a state gets off of the registry by a judge, you know, what at that level in the state. Forgive me, I don't know which level that would be, but that person gets off the registry in that state. They move to another state with all of the expectation that because they were released from the registry in that state, they don't have to register in the new state. Is that fair?
That's been my position for all these years, and I can't find a single person who's ever been prosecuted from coast to coast who has been relieved of registration through a process, be it terminating out on time or being put a petition process, because it's rational for you not to believe you have to register anymore. They do not give you a notice when they terminate you. Chance, you've done thousands and tens of thousands of these. They don't put a notice, and if you should go to Georgia, you'll have a registration of this design, and if you go to Florida, you'll have this, and if you go to Iowa, you'll have this. They don't do any of that. It's rational for you to think you don't have to register anymore. So you would get a notice to register.
Correct.
You would get a notice to register if they discover you in the new state.
That's true.
But you can't guarantee that. As a legal practitioner, he cannot tell a person, don't bother registering. I can guarantee you they won't prosecute you. That would be highly unethical for him to do that.
I agree with that. I understand that. All right. Well, then let's continue along. What did they find on historical treatment of punishment?
Sora was found to resemble traditional punishments like parole and shaming, particularly due to the public nature and significant restraints on registrants.
But then what about affirmative disability or restraints?
Oh, my favorite. The court noted that Sora imposed significant obligations on registrants, including regular reporting and public exposure, which constituted substantial restraints akin to punishment.
And then what about traditional aims of punishment?
Sora was seen to support retribution and deterrence. Traditional aims of punishment, as it was applied based solely on past convictions without any individual risk assessments. So far, this Michigan Supreme Court seems to have it.
And then moving on to, what about any rational connection to a non-punitive purpose?
Well, they stated, quote, while Sora's intent to promote and protect public safety is valid, the inclusion of non-sexual offenses without a clear link to sexual crimes was deemed excessive.
And then what about excessiveness in relation to purpose?
The court concluded that Sora's requirements were excessive for non-sexual offenders as it branded them as sex offenders without evidence of sexual misconduct, leading to social stigma and significant life impacts. Now, what a surprise.
I know, weird, right?
Wow.
I mean, like there are laws in certain states that if you are, if you even like attempt to kidnap a minor, that will put you on the registry. That's not necessarily sexual in nature.
Correct.
All right. Well, under Michigan, the Michigan Constitution, punishment must not be cruel or unusual. The court found that Sora's application to non-sexual offenders like Lyman was grossly disproportionate to the nature of their offenses, violating this constitutional protection. And this is found in the decision on page 27 in paragraph 2. The court highlighted the significant stigma and life-altering consequences of being labeled a PFR, which were unjustified for crimes lacking any sexual component. That's on page 27, paragraph 3. There was a dissenting opinion. Now, Larry, you're not a fan of dissenting opinions. What did they say?
Well, I don't know if I can pronounce these names.
Justices Zahra and Viviano.
They dissented, arguing that the registry requirements for offenses involving minors were reasonable and served a legitimate public safety purpose. And that's on page 27 of paragraph 4. They emphasized that many jurisdictions, including the federal government, include such offenses in the PFR registries, reflecting a broader legislative intent to address crimes associated with potential sexual harm, meaning that you might escalate and evolve.
The dissent criticized...
That's so disingenuous.
And then the
dissent Honestly, there is.
Okay.
So let me, you know, Andy, you're probably confused by why I say that, but there are states like California where California says any offense can be used to put you on the registry, but they got it. But there has to be a hearing and a finding that it's based on sexual compulsion or, you know, something that's sexual in a gratuitous way. It can't just be because of the potential in the future to do a certain thing. So it's a ridiculously disingenuous argument.
Gotcha. Well, then the dissent criticized the majority for misapplying precedent and argued that the registry's civil intent was clear, focusing on public protection rather than punishment, which is on page 28, paragraph 4. They referenced the Smith versus Doe decision, which upheld the constitutionality of similar registries, and argued that SORA should be viewed as a civil measure rather than punitive, page 29, paragraph 2. The vote was 5-2. Now, what happens next?
Well, the Michigan Supreme Court's decision in People versus Lyman marks a significant development in the legal understanding of PFR registries, particularly regarding their application to non-sexual offenses. By ruling that SORA's requirements constituted cruel or unusual punishment for non-sexual offenders, the court underscored the importance of ensuring that legal measures align with constitutional protections and do not impose excessive or unwarranted penalties. Now, this is thanks to ChatGPT. I almost cut and pasted this word for word. This decision has broader implications as well for the application of PFR registries nationwide, challenging states to reassess the balance between public safety objectives and the rights of individuals whose offenses do not involve sexual conduct. Overall, I'd say the Michigan Supreme Court's decision highlights the evolving landscape of legal interpretations, jurisprudence surrounding PFR registries and their impact on individuals' rights and public safety considerations. This is really good stuff. It really is.
Now, answer this, please. Can the state appeal?
Well, I mean, you can always appeal, but I don't think they really have much of an appeal to work with. I mean, they would logically, if they weren't going to do first step, would ask for reconsideration. When you're down 5-2, it's hard to figure out how you would flip that 7-member court. You've got to get to 4. Out of 7, so they've got to flip, what, at least 2, and I don't see that happening, so I see that going nowhere, and they really can't file a viable cert petition because Michigan decided under their constitution, and they get the prerogative of providing a greater protection than the U.S. Constitution. It's kind of like the Adam Walsh Act. If you meet the minimums, you can put everybody at Tier 3 as long as you've met the minimum. If Tier 3 is lifetime, clearly you've met the minimum. The U.S. Supreme Court cannot slap a state for providing greater protection. Can they, Chance? I don't know what they could do here. I don't see a pathway to the U.S. Supreme Court on this.
No, and I really don't. I mean, you know, Michigan's able to give their citizens more than the mandatory minimum requires, and that's what the federal standard is, the mandatory minimum.
Interesting. Well, very well. We are running very long. Can we move over to California Corner?
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Let's do. We can have this great guest, James. Let's open it up.
Very well.
All right. So
go ahead, James. Take it away.
Thank you. Okay, California Corner. You don't have to live under the shadow of the registry. I just love that. That came from James, who's an advocate for social justice and criminal justice reform. And rather than me tell you about him, I think he can do a pretty good job doing it himself. Welcome, James. Say hello to everybody.
Hey, thanks, Chance, and hello, everyone. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Okay. James, I'm just going to start this off because I am so amazed by you. And so you know, just in awe. I mean, you literally were doing life in prison, and then you got out of prison and you were doing life on parole. And then a couple of days ago, you were discharged. So today you are free. How in the world did you accomplish the seemingly impossible task? How did you do that?
You know, that's the funny thing. I mean, I've been asked that by several different attorneys out here in California, you know, and I just marvel at the fact that, you know, it's just, you know, the first thing you have to do is you just have to be resilient and you have to have hope. And you got to believe in yourself. You know, you can't allow yourself to be, you know, placed under that rock, you know, and labeled with that stigma that so many people are feeling is that is part of the process of being on, you know, on the registry, you know. So for me, for my story, you know, my story goes back 35 years ago when I committed my offense. And, you know, I didn't stay out of prison after I served my time on that offense. It was a misdemeanor offense. And I committed a life crime offense. I committed a violent crime of murder. And so I ended up spending 28 years of my life behind bars. And as a result of, the offense that I committed, that led to me being a PFR, that increased my risk level with the static 99, which in turn increased the stigmatizing consequences that follow as a result of having high risk factors for reoffense. I did 28 years in prison with somebody who knew that when they were getting out was going to be on the registry. And I lived my life every single day with the mindset that I need to, you know, I need to self-preserve if I'm ever going to have a chance at being able to get out and live a life. You know, one of the battles that I was fighting with the Department of Corrections is the mislabeling and the misidentifying of charges as, you know, as well as offenses. And, you know, trying to prove, you know, certain elements of an offense didn't happen when you're locked up is, it's a challenge. It's very challenging. And in the process of doing that, you know, I had to learn to survive with, you know, being somebody on a mainline prison yard who was convicted of an offense that would require me to be on the registry when I was, eventually released. If I was released, I was serving a life term sentence, you know, You know, so I got involved with the gang mentality. I got involved with the lifestyle of, you know, following orders from somebody else simply for my own self-preservation and survival. You know, for me, what changed it was I decided to stop blaming myself and others for things that were beyond my control and the trauma that I experienced as a teenager and a young man growing up in the foster care system. And, you know, stop putting blame on all the things that resulted in me being foolish, irresponsible, reckless, self-centered, and thoughtless, including being kicked out of the Marine Corps with a bad conduct discharge, you know, including blaming everybody for living on the streets for 2 years, homeless, living out of a Salvation Army box behind a department store, you know, and just working odd jobs to make ends meet. And I reached a point in developing insight, you know,
And let me ask you, let me ask you something, James. So it sounds like at some point you started to account for your behavior. So you started to say, look, it's not the town, it's me. It's my responsibility. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I had to look at myself in the mirror and, you know, basically after 5 times of being denied parole, you know, by the California Board of Parole hearings, I had to sit there and look at myself and say, you know, what the fuck is wrong with me? You know, and what was wrong with me was the fact that I just kept putting blame on the fact that I was a recalcitrant miscreant. And, you know, and that was a term that was given to me by one of the Board of Parole hearing commissioners. And I had to really go back and do that self-evaluation, that self-analyzation of who I was as a human being. I had to start taking responsibility. I had to start being accountable for my actions. And
what about, you know, what about James? What about, you know, I know you, you know, you went through the foster care system and, you know, there's a lot of issues that you had to deal with in your life. You know, that kind of calcifies your heart. Where and when did you start being empathetic and feeling remorse for anything?
Well, you know, that's a story in and of itself. You know, I was in a California prison, serving an indeterminate shoot term. And I was on my approximately 7th year, and I ended up meeting, a woman who is now my wife. And, you know, we formed a letter writing relationship while I was locked up. And she was basically the first person, you know, to ever really come into my life and offer me hope and offer me support. And her background is in higher education. And she said, well, you know, you might want to give higher education a chance, you know. And I always felt that I wasn't good enough. You know, growing up, I was told, hey, you're too stupid to be anything but stupid. So that was my mindset. I didn't think that I could go into higher ed, but I was wrong. You know, I eventually was able to drop out of the gangs, ended up going into a program outside of the mainline prison population, and it's called the SMY, Special Needs, Sensitive Needs Yard, and I gave myself a chance. And I started giving myself a chance by enrolling in college. So I eventually earned my first associate's degree in social and behavioral science. And in that process, I began to really take stock of who I am and who I was as a human being. And I began to start the building block process of what I wanted my future to look like in the event that I was ever able to be found suitable for parole. You know, I basically...
Okay, so let me stop you there for a minute, because, you know, this is so important. So what you're describing here is setting the stage for reintegration back into the community, because that's what it sounds like you're saying. So, you know, when did you start that? How far into the process were you before you started that?
Well, I was, after I left the security housing unit, and I ended up going to the SMY yard, That's where I started it. It was, I would say, 2007. You know, wow. 2007 is when I started. And, you know, the way I look at it now, I mean, geez, 28 years of my life behind bars. And for most of that time, I was just a wreck because I was blaming everybody for every poor choice, bad decision, wrong action. You know, every unlawful act or every immoral decision I made on somebody else, I was blaming it on everybody else but me, you know? And well,
it sounds like at some point through your education, you must have developed some kind of insight as to why you behave like that in the first place.
Yeah, you know, and you're right, Chance. I mean, once you start taking that, you know, that self-inventory, you know, and I'm a big 12-stepper, you know, that was one of the issues with the parole board. And when I went to the parole board, they said, well, why don't you go to NA and AA and all these self-help programs? I said, because I don't have a problem. You know, I'm not an addict. You know, I did steroids for 3 years. That's not a drug, you know. But what made me really reflect on the type of behaviors that I was involved with and committing and these harms that I was committing on other people was the fact that my life was unmanageable. And I've always carried that to the degree that if my life is unmanageable, that means I'm living an unhealthy lifestyle, you know? So finding a balance came with education. And that's how I stayed it. That's how I begin to develop into a human being. Instead of being looked at as a monster, instead of being looked at as, you know, somebody who committed an offense that has now placed me on the registry, I decided to take all of that and turn it into something positive, you know, and that began.
Let's talk about that for a minute. I mean, yeah. And, you know, so at some point you came to that conclusion and you were thinking, okay, I'm going to turn this into something positive. So you're looking towards the future. What were you able to accomplish?
Wow. You know, first of all, I created my post-prison plan, which included a relapse prevention plan, high-risk behavior plan, as, you know, and these were necessary things for me for when I got out. And then I really wanted to stay in touch with me. You know, I told myself if I ever got the opportunity to be found suitable for parole and get back out of the community, then the one thing that I would be committed to was to continue elevating myself so that I can reach back and lift others up with me, you know? And that's where I'm at today. You know, today, you know, since I've been out, I was paroled on, I was found suitable for parole on December 12, 2018. I was released from the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation on April 30th, 2019. And in that time, I earned another associate's degree in Human Services Addiction Studies. That ended up allowing me to go to a California university, where I earned a Bachelor's of Science in Rehabilitation Services. And now, in December, I will be conferred with my Master's of Social Work at the University of Southern California. So, you know, giving back and living my life right, you know, has been the catalyst for, you know, waking up every morning and just realizing that the only easy day was yesterday, but today is going to be a new day, and how can I make it better for me?
And so in making it better for you, you've made it better for other people. I mean, you know, tell our audience what you've been able to accomplish. I mean, it's just amazing. Well, I've read your bio. It's amazing. What have you done?
Oh, man. I mean, what haven't I done? I mean, from the moment I got out, out of prison, I hit the ground running. I wasn't going to allow the fact that I was going to be wearing a GPS hold me back, you know? And so I started making contributions to the community. You know, in college, I was the president of a rehabilitation counseling association. And that allowed me to start working with people in the community on in the Skid Row area and in disenfranchised areas, and just really immerse myself in places and opportunities. And I would take these opportunities and they would become additional building blocks for me to, you know, build myself into a contributing member of society. You know, I'm on the registry. I'm on life parole. I'm wearing a GPS, you know, and what I'm doing is I'm not hiding it. I'm actually working in places I know I can get employment because this is the field and this is where people like me are able to find employment. I'm a program manager for a nonprofit organization that actually helps men and women reintegrate back into society. You know, I help them create their own post-prison relapse prevention plans and education plans and work in family reunification plans. That's what I do. You know, I've been recognized by U.S. Congress twice for the work that I do with the people in the community during all the pandemic, and then also working with justice impacted veterans. You know, and on that note, you know, just getting off parole, I've been invited to Chicago on, you know, from Thursday to Saturday at the University of Chicago to a veterans a VA program conference that is going to be talking about rehabilitation, restoration, and resilience. And I'm going to be one of the featured speakers on Friday. And it just feels really good. And it's particularly when I'm talking to the organizers this morning, you know, and I had to tell them, I said, look, you know, I can't be in Chicago more than 3 days. And they said, oh, is, you know, 24 hours each day? I said, no, 3 days. So the moment I get there, that begins one day, you know, and then it's two more days after that. So they were kind enough to reorganize the schedule to allow me, a PFR, to have an opportunity to share my story, to inspire hope, because there's many people out there that could be or might be or are similarly situated, but really don't really have an opportunity to develop or have a voice to be able to take that first step to their own personal transformation and change because of the fear of being on the registry. And I love that.
I mean, what you're saying then is that this journey that you've been on, it's not so unique. Other people can do it too, right?
Yeah, there's the thing here is that persons that are on the registry, we're all unique in our own way, you know? And you don't have to be, you know, pigeonholed by a decision or by you know, an improper accusation or anything of the nature that, you know, now has you resulting in being a PFR. You know, the resilience that it takes to rise above the stigma and the consequences that follow when you get out of prison or when you get out of jail, or even when you're off parole and you're not a lifer, or, you know, just being on the registry, whether it's 10 years, 25 years, whether it's life, you always got to have hope, you know? You always got to have hope. There's always going to be a light at the end of the tunnel if you just give yourself a chance. And that's what I gave myself. I gave myself a chance. Even when I was knocked down, when they told me, no, we're going to reject you. We're not going to give you a discharge because you got two violations. And I said, I have two violations with mitigating circumstances. You know, that's what I wrote in my appeal. And I said, and these mitigating circumstances were never considered. I was at a park. You say I was at a park, but nowhere was it labeled a park, you know? And then I was released from county jail 4 days later after a judge said, I don't see it as a park. So they continued me on parole. And then my second violation is a mix-up with a treatment therapy session, not on my fault, but on the part of the therapist, who was inconsistent in his timing for a telephonic therapy session while I was walking a dog that I had just basically, you know, taken ownership and care of when his owner died the day before. And yeah, when I
you know what it sounds like, James? I mean, it sounds like you just never took no for an answer.
That's right.
It sounds like you never gave up, and it sounds like your eyes were fixed on the future. And
that's right.
Now you're on your way to Chicago, and you're a free man. I mean, it's amazing. And I just, you know, I want to before we close here, I just, you know, want to give Larry and Andy a chance to ask you whatever they want to ask you. But congratulations again. I am so personally gratified by listening to you and knowing that you were discharged a couple of days ago and that you're free. Larry, Andy?
I appreciate it.
Do you have anything? You can go for us.
I will say that you're inspiring with your passion and the way you've analyzed yourself and the achievements. I wish I could match those achievements. I mean, I did go through the foster care system. I can relate to some of what you said, but you're very, very inspiring to recognize what went wrong. And hopefully PFRs are listening that think their life is over. This will help you to realize your life is not over. There are opportunities available.
Yeah, you're right, Larry. I mean, you know, you don't have to have all the answers. You're not expected to have all the answers. You know, it's just take a moment to really do that self-inventory, look into your heart and ask yourself, where do you want to go? What do you want to do? And then create a plan on how you want to get there, you know, and be happy with every step and every achievement and every opportunity you get, you know, to make a difference. Because the more that you stay out there, the more that you advance, then you're also furthering and distancing your past, you know? And that's relevant. That's relevant. If you're trying to show people that you've changed, that you've transformed, that you're somebody that they can believe in, that they can trust, that's what it's all about. Because as soon as people start realizing, hey, you know what? You made a poor choice. You have it, you know, or this accusation was leveled against you. But I look at you as somebody that's a human being because this is how I've gotten to know you. That's what matters. You don't need everybody to like you. You just need those that support you to say, hey, I'm here for you and I support you and believe in you.
Those are the angels in the architecture, Andy.
Yeah, I noticed something about you that I have a handful of close PFR type friends and then just some others that I interact with tangentially. And I'm personally a big believer in a positive mental attitude, even though this is a really shitty situation to be in. It seems that those that have had positive attitudes have then overcome the challenges. Friend of mine who I'm very close with, he got out of prison and he was working in a Georgia, like they clean out plastic 55-gallon drums, and he's working outside in the back of a trailer, and it's the middle of July in Georgia, so it's like 110, 120 inside the trailer, and he's playing he's playing Donkey Kong in the back of a trailer, and it's freaking hot. He's sweating, and just pushes through. And now he has a much better situation. He's married, he's got a beautiful, lovely wife, and they have a house together, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. My situation is, you know, I went through a certain amount of struggles, and I have a great situation, and others, and others, and others. And I've had conversations like this with Larry. Anywho, all that to come back around and ask you, it sounds like it's a positive mental attitude in a lot of these cases that at least helps you cross over the hurdles to move on instead of always dragging everybody else down and saying, oh, woe is me. This sucks. I can't do anything.
Yeah. You know, Andy, and that's exactly it. You know, I mean, you know, you put your best foot forward and you just do the best that you can. You know, you're not out there to try to impress anybody. You're just there trying to survive. And as you're surviving for yourself, you'll be surprised with the people that want to support you if they also see that you have a positive attitude and a healthy outlook on where your life wants to go. You know, And I never gave up. And I'm still not giving up. You know, registry is just another step, you know, but these are things that I'm unable to change at the time. So I'm not worried about them. I just put, you know, I just put my feet in the right direction and continue living my life right. And eventually those things will take, you know, will take its course in the time that it takes. And I'm just going to be grateful for each and every moment that I'm out, you know. And if I can leave just one imparting, you know, piece of wisdom with people out there, it's just, you matter, you know.
I like it.
You matter. And just take that to heart. And anybody that is a PFR, I want you to take that moment and just reflect on that, that you matter.
I want to say something too, James, and I want to thank you for saying that, because it just touches my heart. That here's James. He was in prison for life. Then he was on parole. Now he is free, and within a few years, he will be off the registry. Okay, and he's got his life in front of him. And I think that as an example of what can be done here, James is all of it. And I appreciate you joining us, James. I just want to thank you again.
Appreciate it very much, James.
I wish I would have known about this earlier, because knowledge is power, you know? But more than that, it's a means of being able to transmit transformation, you know? And as we leave here today, something is going to follow with us. And if we're able to just pass any part of what we hear today on to somebody else, that's making the world safer. And it's also making the world just a little bit better for each of us.
Perfect. Perfect. Thank you, James.
Thank you very much, James, for coming on. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, gentlemen, I think we can close the show down. We definitely run over, but I don't think that that's really a bad thing. It was certainly worth it to hear all that James had to offer up. Larry, is there anything else you want to offer up before we close out?
No, really appreciate James being here and inspiring us. Thank you. We'll see you in about a month.
You're still in that game. Chance, do you have anything before we go?
You've been listening to F.
No, just you guys are the best. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Enjoyed the best. Hugs all around. Everybody head over to registrymatters.co for finding the show notes. And then, of course, always leave some voicemail at 747-227-4477. You can even just say hi and I'll probably play it. Email registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And of course, if you would like to support us, you can head over to patreon.com/registrymatters. And that is also so very much appreciated. One of our longtime listeners decided to up his to approximately close to the stimulus check, Larry. So that was pretty awesome. Thank you, Carl. He isn't even joining us tonight. That's all I got, everybody. And thanks, everyone, for hanging out for the longer show. And we will see you very soon. Have a great night, Larry. Have a great night, Larry. Chance, excuse me.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.